To introduce the official panel here, we've got Ed Rotberg, Al Alcorn, Steve Ritchie, and who's this guy? Eugene Jarvis, I guess. Maybe some of you know him. And then Dave Shepard is joining us this time. So we'll turn it over to them. I'm sure they've got much more interesting things to say than I possibly could.
This thing doesn't work. All right. I'd just like to say that Robotron is too hard.
I guess I'm the oldest guy. It turns out being here. We started at Atari in 72 and did Pong. Funny story. Recently, the Discovery Channel was doing a thing on old collectible stuff, and I happened to have kept all the old prototypes. So I dragged the old Pong, original Pong prototype out and had it there at the Computer History Museum while they were filming it. The funny part was, this was about 6 months ago, somebody said, hey, Al, come on over here. It's on a Wednesday, and they got the PDP one running at the Computer History Museum, and I got to play Space War on a PDP one, which is like the ultimate video game ever played, and the Discovery Channel couldn't care less about it because it wasn't on their list of things to film that day. But so, to me, the old Pong game was interesting, but wow. I think on the weekends they're open, and if you're lucky, you can get in there and maybe get a chance to play it. So that's something you guys want to look at. So,
okay. I just wanted to, it's interesting, riffing off on Al here. I had an experience with Space Wars, and in fact, that was the first game I got into. It was running in the when I was at Berkeley, when I was this is 1973. It was running on an ancient, it was like an IBM 709 or something, which it was in the basement of the physics lab, and this computer was so obsolete that you could actually, there was like boards that were like a bit, you know, and you could like pull the board out and the computer had like one less bit, you know, which was a big deal because it only had about 20 of them. So the, we would load the thing in with punch cards and I think the game ran on like an oscilloscope and we used like POTS or something as a control. So with a fire button. And, it was just amazing fun, playing that game. Especially with all the, you know, you could have negative gravity and positive gravity and just amazing, amazing achievement Space Wars was. You know, just such a tremendously sophisticated game in comparison to Pong. Anyway.
We were totally addicted to it. I remember the game number, 9-2. We'd punch that in the keyboard and play it. It was an awesome game.
Yeah, I started with Atari in 76. I was exposed to video games in at Santa Cruz Boardwalk, where I saw the first Atari game. And so I thought that was really cool, so I just went home and built one out of parts, you know, spare parts, junk parts and stuff. But it was all, there was no computer in it. And then I went back to Boardwalk about, I don't know, 6 or 8 months later, and there was another one, a different game. And I thought, oh, man, this is great, except now I got to redesign the whole thing and start from scratch. And right at that time, Altair came out with their 8800 home computer kit. So I bought one of those and hooked it up to my video system. And I started programming games at home, and the neighbors would all come over, and we all just sit around and play games all night. And then I saw an ad in the paper one day, Atari's looking for somebody. So I said, okay, I'll go over there and see what they have. And I put all my crap in the car and took it over there to show it to them and said, I know how to do video games. Here's stuff in the car I can show you. But they didn't want to see it. They weren't the least bit interested in seeing it, and they hired me on the spot. So,
who hired you?
Shoot, I forgot his name now.
Lyle?
No. Lyle was working there at the time. He was doing, Lyle and Dan Van were working there. I think Dan was a technician. I forgot. The guys, he took off on a bicycle trip like a week after I started. You know, a cross-country bicycle trip.
Never came back.
He never came back.
Yeah.
I don't remember his name. Yeah.
You know, that might be an interesting thing is to talk about how we got into the business in the first place. I think that's probably some people might be interested in that. For me, I had been working at the time. I was working at GD Cyril Pharmaceuticals in Chicago. I was interfacing microcomputers to lab equipment. And I was also, you know, once you got a request to do one, you'd put that together and usually get it done a bit early. And so in my spare time, of which I had too much at that job, I was programming games. And I remember at the time, the hot little board game was Mastermind. I don't know if you guys ever remember that one where with little pegs, the colored pegs, trying to figure everything out. So I programmed, you know, these purported, you know, laboratory data collection devices to, with the right, you know, backdoor key code to, you know, play Mastermind so the lab technicians could, you know, while away their time and waste everybody's time. And so eventually, one of the people working there said, you know, I saw this thing in InfoWorld. Do you read InfoWorld? And I didn't read InfoWorld. And there was an ad for Atari, you know, and they said, this sounds just like, you know, what you want to do. So I said, well, what the heck? I sent in a resume, and next thing I know, I got a phone call. I got some guy named Steve Kalfi was asking me a whole bunch of technical questions on the phone, and I guess it was good enough because he then flew out. He was doing a flying tour to interview some people who passed his phone interview, and so he was staying in a hotel at O'Hare Airport outside of Chicago. So I drove out there, and you know, I'm wearing a suit and a tie, and I walk in there, and here's Calpy, you know, in a T-shirt and blue jeans. And I think what got me the job is the first thing I did is said, thank God, and I took the tie and the coat off and threw them down, and then we just started to talk. So I think that's why I got the job.
Well, that's actually an interesting thread. I got the job at Atari. Actually, it wasn't Atari at the time. It was Syzygy, Syzygy. Because I think I was the cheapest guy over at Ampex that no one could steal. Ampex, we started at Ampex in about 1968. I was still a student at Cal doing a work-study project, and Nolan was there, Ted Dabney, and a bunch of the Steve Mayer, a bunch of the other early guys from Atari were all there. And Ampex in 1972, I came back. I was working in the video file group, and it was having Ampex had a real recession, real trouble. Nolan had worked there before. He wasn't the greatest engineer, but he was a wheeler dealer entrepreneur, and he had left in 70-71 to go do this stupid idea of a coin-op video game. It was called Computer Space, and we all thought that was really, really a stupid thing at the time. You got to realize that people did not do startup companies. The word entrepreneur did not exist. Venture capital was something that did not happen down there. So, and once you had a good job at Ampex, in those up to that point, it was like you had a career, and why would you ever quit a good job at Ampex, you know? And Nolan had this idea, and at the time, Nutting Associates was the only coin-op manufacturer west of Chicago. So Nolan went to these guys and gave them this idea, or sold them the idea for a coin-op video game called Computer Space. And he maintained this company called Syzygy, which was an engineering consulting contracting firm with him and Ted Dabney in it. And he got royalties for it. Computer Space didn't do very well. It sold, less than 1,000 machines. But it was a start, and he got into a dispute with Bill Nutting. So he started his own company, and he went over. I remember he hired me. I was at Ampex at the time. It was summer of 72, and we go out to lunch. It's Ted Nolan come back with Ted, and they're driving this 70 brand new 72 Buick station wagon. It was a company car. I said, what's a company car? What's a car you get and you don't have to pay for it? I go, wow, what a concept. You know, I was like 22 out of Berkeley, and this is great. Wow, what a deal. And he offered me $1,000 a month salary in stock. Well, I mean, I figured this thing would flop. But and I was less than I was making at Ampex. I was making, I think, $1,200 by this time. But I figured, what the hell? Ampex was kind of in trouble, and I'd go off and do this. It'd be a lot of fun to go off and do something like this. And when it tanked, I'd just come back to work at Ampex. I figured they'd hire me back. You know, something would happen. So, and the rest, I guess, is history. He had me doing this thing, this funny thing, this test project, which was the simplest game he could think of. What he did was he saw the Magnavox Odyssey game at a trade show, and it was a terrible game. Plastic on the TV set screen, you had to put pieces, and it was a terrible game, and Nolan thought it was so simple that he'd give it to me to knock off, and I could practice at it, and then he'd give me the real game that would be something more complex in Computer Space. Well, you know what? In retrospect, it was like the movie. It was like the producers. Because if you steal something that's a flop, there's no problem, right? So he never told me it was a test. He told me he had a contract from General Electric for a consumer game and all this typical bullshit to get me in, you know, trying real hard. And I'm sitting there by myself going, Jesus Christ, I've got too many parts in here to be a consumer home game, you know. But it was playing pretty good. I added the speed up, the sounds and stuff like that. And so we went off and, you know, put it in a box, and the rest was history. It sold quite well. It did quite well. And now we had a problem because, like the producers, we got a hit on our hands, and it's a theft of somebody else's game, you know. And I tell a story, because I still do startup companies, that people worry a lot about, gee, is there prior art in this patent or something like that? You do a good job, and we all borrow ideas or get inspired by other products, and that's how it always works. And if you truly are infringing on somebody's patent, if they got, they'll send you a letter, and you got attorneys, and if you're making money, it'll work out. But if you're not making money, they won't send you the letter. Don't worry about it. It's a high class problem, you know. So that's what happened. We settled with Magnavox and went on with our life. And other people had to pay grief on that, but we got a paid up license. So that's how I got to Atari.
I got to Atari in 1974. I was kind of tired and broke. I was trying to be a rock musician. We had a decent band, but so did everyone else. There'd be five bands on every block. So I wandered into Atari, and I was hired by John Petlansky. I was employee number 50, and I remember him. I'm gonna tell some stories here.
What department? What was Petlansky?
The electromechanical department. I was servicing lines and making harnesses, and it was a good thing, you know.
Okay.
And so, you know, it was fine with me.
Lascatus?
Yes, Los Gatos, and I started working on the line for John Petlansky. I designed the, and I had electrical knowledge, and so I had done the big burn-in ovens with the stand-up thing, and the rheostats, and the big orange tester, the one that could had programmable plugs, and you know, it certainly wasn't high-level electronics. That's why I really don't belong up here with you guys. You know,
we're part of it.
Software geniuses. Anyway.
Okay, moving right along. No.
Okay, I'm just going to bring up this one interesting thing. It's like on Fridays at Atari, we'd end up on the back dock. I'm just going to tell the dock part. Well, no, I'm not. Okay. We had hardware in that time was TTL. Every PC board ever came out of the machine had to be tested. And there were rows of testers, and they would test each game, and they'd be working there. Well, on the tester's table every Friday would be a big, I mean, big tray of brownies. And we would eat those brownies, and at the end of the day, there was no one, okay, who wasn't fucked up. The whole company, okay. But then the wine would come out later. Red Mountain, right? The big bottles of Red Mountain on the dock, and other smokables. This is what I recall. And we would sit out there and try not to attract the police, and sort of in the back of the building.
I was in engineering.
Yeah, yeah, right.
We were clean.
No, I could testify the engineers were completely clean. It was just the inter-office mail, some of the things that were mailed around in those manila envelopes, you know, kind of spices, you know, spicy.
You don't see those anymore, do you?
I guess my employment story, you know, I never had any ambition to be a video game guy. I thought they kind of stunk. Pong, you know. But that was some crappy engineering. Anyway, I interviewed it. I was in went to Berkeley, as I was saying earlier, and I interviewed at Atari. I guess the guy from Atari came to campus. I'm like, oh, cool, man, I'll work for Atari, because it was cool guys, you know, cool guys, and cool stuff happened on the loading dock. And it's like, hey, I want to get into that, you know. And so, you know, I interviewed, and like I just never heard again from them until I guess about 6 months later. They finally called me up and they said, "Hey, come on in. You got a job." I'm like, okay. And so I got in, and it was they were starting a new division to do pinball games. And it was, you know, they had, you know, everybody that ever designed a pinball game was stupid. And so they had to do everything different and new. And they all kind of blew up. Anyway, the I guess about after a week, my boss quit. The guy that hired me quit. And then a week after that, his boss quit. And so I was like head of the department at that point.
What were the names?
Don Lang.
Don Lang.
Don Lang and I guess Jeff Harrop. He never quit. I wish he did head of, but then so I was kind of head of the software department at pinball. And I guess the funniest story I ever had was Nolan used to come down. This was in Borregas Avenue in Sunnyvale. I was a late guy. Anyway, and Borregas Avenue, Nolan and the bigwigs were upstairs, and the peons were downstairs. And so we were downstairs, you know, making the games, and Nolan and Gene Lipkin, who was the, I don't know, kind of the hitman or something. VP of CoinOp. And those guys would come down, and Nolan would kind of go, wow, this is pretty cool, and Gene would say, that sucks, you know. And so I remember there was a friend of mine, Dave Sherman, who spent a year designing this boat game that had like little hardware, you know, fuzzy waves and everything and all this stuff. And, you know, he was really proud of this. He spent an entire year on this. And Gene Lipkin came down and looked at the game and played it for about 10 seconds. And he said, you know what? Boat games suck. And and that was the end of that project. So... and they did. They did suck pretty much. I think he was right. There was, I guess, Hydro Thunder sold. But anyway, on to Dave here.
Yeah. Well, I was, I guess I was a goody two shoes because I never got involved in any of the stuff that was going on.
You'd lie.
Yeah.
Hey, I sent you mail.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I never got that thing you sent me. So in my early years, I was a game programmer. And, I did a few games, but I think my real love was in doing the tools, development tools for the programmers and stuff. I got more reward from the instant gratification of doing something and watching the guys use it right away than months or sometimes years later, you know, before your product actually hits the field and you get some kind of a return. And so I always liked the tools. And so after a while, the company got so big that we needed a full-time crew just to do the tools. I was kind of doing it part-time for the first few years. And that's kind of where I stuck until probably the late 90s, mid to the late 90s, when I got tired of it. It got too big. The company got too big. The networks got huge. We have thousands of nodes on the internet and our intranet, and it just got to be a pain in the ass. So it's like, I'm going to go back to games. So I went back to doing operating system kind of stuff in the games. And it was interesting, the all the shenanigans that was going on in the company, the changing of the names and the moves and you know, things weren't going. We'd have a successful game and everybody'd be happy, but then the next game would be a dog, and so then they'd have to say, well, we have to cancel all these things and change, reorganize. That seemed to be the favorite thing to do, was just to reorganize if things weren't going quite according to plan. But I kind of stuck it out, and it was a lot of fun, and I have no regrets. It was pretty cool. And Roboton is still my favorite game, even though we had nothing to do with it.
Well, you know, Williams Midway did buy Atari later on, so right. So we were all one happy family.
I think there's... I would just like to clarify something for some of the younger people. Eugene talked about inter-office mail. They were these large manila envelopes that you could reuse. They had holes punched through them. And it was kind of the precursor for you younger people for email. And in addition to putting in, you know, the mail that you were going to send around, you could put in attachments. So I think Eugene was referring to some of the attachments that were occasionally included. This is just a translation for the older people. I'm sure remember the inter-office mail envelopes, and they'd have a list of names, so you could route it to a person, then cross off that name when you got it, and route it to the next person. And I don't know if anybody's using those anymore, inter-office mail. And And then about Robotron and Defender. And, I mean, one of the nice things about, you know, working at Atari was whenever the competitors would come out with a new game that was doing well, our distributors would send one off to our engineering department for us to research. I guess that's a kind word for it. And so in addition to, you know, working on our games, we did a lot of research. And and you know, we'd routine, and you talked a lot about Berserk, and that was a game that was tuned with its control, spent an awful lot of time researching Berserk, and I think I injured my wrist a few times on it, and I think we wore the control out on it. That was a lot of fun doing that stuff.
Well, I want to talk about pinball a little bit, and this guy, and how Atari got into pinball. And why, and how we screwed it up a little bit, but we certainly changed the industry. If nothing else, what we did changed the industry.
No doubt.
And Nolan had this idea that was half specious, but he's bold enough to try it anyhow, to make an electronic pinball machine, microprocessor driven. He had this idea for a wider play field, and that it would bring more to the marketplace. It never occurred to him that it was going to put more stuff on the play field, if it's going to be wider and bigger, acreage. And that was going to cost more. Secondly, the manufacturing process of pinballs, as it was done at that point in Chicago, was one from starting with wire and dirt and making a pinball machine. And we out in Silicon Valley were buying relays and stuff at a high price. So I don't think we ever made a dime off any pinballs we ever sold. But that aside, the typical Atari story, I think, was when we were first developing our first pinball playfield, and I guess the Atarians was the first one.
Bob Jonesy.
Yeah, oh my goodness. Bob Jonesy. We had several false starts on this one. But no, we were having a big distributor meeting. It was April. It was March 30th or something. It was going to be up in San Francisco, our first ever Atari distributor meeting, when we were big enough now to get all the world's distributors to come to us to go do an event. Of course, all the competition at the time around us was leveraging off of that, since all the distributors were in town anyhow. So we had it up at San Francisco at the Hyatt Regency, and we were in the suite, being Nolan, Joe, and the gang. And Nolan and Gene, or somehow occurred to us that the next day was April 1st. So let's have some fun with our distributors. I mean, this is like unheard of doing this. So I was also busy building the next home video game at the time. We just purchased a graphic computer called the Calma for designing chips. This is in the home division, as far away as you could possibly get from pinball. Atari was expanding. So we had this idea. We had a pinball playfield, and we figured, Nolan said, let's digitize the playfield, put it on the Calma machine. I'm going to get a buses lined up. We're going to give all the distributors down to your secret research. I literally had this secret place down the street on Winchester Boulevard. Mm-hmm. I had this lab where we were doing the Atari VCS and some of those chips there at the time. And this was pretty confidential. It had it way about 3 or 4 blocks away from the main engineering building. And no one's going to take a goddamn Greyhound buses and bring all our distributors to see this secret lab. Typical. And he says, I want to play. So I call up. I said, okay. So I call the guys up that are running it. And I said, stop all the chip work for tomorrow. And I want you to get the pinball playfield from Jarvis, whoever was doing it. Who did that first playfield layout?
Bob Jonesy did the first layout. I don't remember who was programming it, though.
Well, no, without programming it.
You weren't there yet.
Recently, Fred Yates.
Yes, that's
yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So
Yates.
Yeah,
exactly
Yates.
Exactly right.
Yeah. Wow. So anyway, so these guys said, no, you're full of shit. I won't do this. And I go, no, I'm telling you, you got to do it. These guys were chip designers. Lynn Paul, just go along with the gag. So, okay. So they digitized. So we had this thing. They're looking, and we brought the whole crew by. They didn't know what they were looking at. And Nolan said, okay, move that thumper bumper over as an object. And we did. You know, it was an object. You could move it at that time. That was a big deal on these old Tektronics. These were Tektronics storage displays. It was, oh, man, old technology by today's standard, bleeding edge by then. And now we automatically percentage the play field. Whatever, you know, and so he goes to a display status tool, all these numbers pop up, and see, we moved it, and the numbers changed, see, like, wow. And so there was one guy, Arnold Kamikow, at the time, he was like, he was the hotshot guy, the distributor. Was very technical, but it wasn't really. And he missed the tour. We gave a special tour for him so he could see it and report back on it. And we figured we couldn't keep a secret at Atari. So we figured we'd put bullshit out and make the job of the competitors to separate the bullshit from the good stuff. And I remember when this guy, eventually, they were saying, you're never going to be able to build a pinball machine. It's any
good.
Bob
would say that to us every day, and he was kind
of
right.
You know, anything west of Chicago, it can't be done. But he did a great job, and they eventually took you to Chicago, right?
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, what's going on? How come they're stealing guys from California to go to Chicago to design Playfield, huh? No, he really changed the industry. He made good pinball. We just couldn't make any money at it in California.
Well, one of the big problems was that Nolan insisted on this new technology that was ridiculous.
Yeah.
Okay, when you see how everybody's doing everything already, and you're making a new thing, I mean, you know, some stuff like flipper coils and mechanisms, there weren't any patents.
Remember the rotary reel?
The rotary flipper was our downfall for the first three models. I mean,
yeah, he insisted
no
on
doubt
this.
About it. And he wanted those, and they were made from Leadex channel changers on transmitters. You know, it's like it was a ridiculous thing, but
that's
what he wanted us to do. And Eugene and I had crazy new ideas. We saw all these things that people were doing with with sound and pinball play, and we tried to. You know, so I guess that was the third game, wasn't it? Airborne Adventure was Atari's third game. The first two were tough. They were just hard to make, and the second one was like, holy mackerel! This was like. This had two flippers over here and two over here. So what do you do with that? You know, everything you know is wrong. Everything, okay? All right, so if you hit this flipper button, then these two flippers go like that. But that's over there on the left side. What's the left side doing flipping when I hit the right flipper button?
It's innovation. Innovation, Steve.
What are these about? And, you know, no matter how you played it, it didn't work. Anyway, no one finally got over that, and we got on his case and decided that we would tell him that if we wanted to be competitive in the pinball business, we would have to utilize the normal components. He refused to budge on the width of the game, and it was, I don't even remember the width, but a normal was 20 and a quarter, and he always insisted on the wide one.
Yeah.
I found a way to close up the flippers and the slingshots and make it play like a narrow body and worry about the wide stuff, you know, when you could.
That was the thing about Nolan, just in general. When Nolan walked into a room and started any conversation with, I believe, that was the time you wanted to start ducking for the exits as fast as you could.
What amazed me is, just kind of the new guy on the block, and Nolan, he just had amazing, crazy ideas. Oh. You know, and 98% of them were completely just impractical, complete rubbish, and but really interesting. And he just, what you had to do is you just kind of say, yeah, oh, that's a really good idea, and just kind of like next week he'd forget about it.
I'll tell you the story where a breakout came from. That exemplifies the whole problem. Nolan would go in, and he had the attention span of a golden retriever, all right? So, and unfortunately, designing an engineering project of any kind takes at least 3 months, sometimes 6 to 9 months for something good, and Nolan would get bored. So he'd go in engineering, he'd say, oh, stop doing that, do this, I got something better idea. Well, of course, if you do that, nothing is ever going to get out. So I argued with Nolan about this, and I figured I couldn't stop him. So what I did was we had to have security. Our attorney said, look, you got to put, kind of locks on the door and at least advise people that it's a private area. So we said, okay, we dressed it up. Remember we had a picture of the shootout of Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid on the door over in Los Gatos. And I had Pat Ewart was the receptionist or the engineering secretary. And I had a beeper, a buzzer, a pager, such that whenever Nolan went into the lab, I'd get paged. It was the only thing it was used for. And so I just followed behind Nolan and, I'd say, remind the guy that I was the one going to sign the paycheck. And if he listened, you can listen to Nolan and talk to him all you want. But if you stop doing what I tell you to do, I'm going to stop paying you, okay? So Nolan got frustrated. So then what he would do is he went and he going to snipe the lowest guys in engineering on his secret project without telling me. Well, at that time, the lowest guy in engineering was this little 18-year-old dropout that couldn't design much of anything in tech. His game was, I think, Steve Jobs. Yeah, and so he corners Steve, and over in a corner and describes this game to what became Breakout to him. And he says, I'll tell you what, every chip less than 50, I'm going to give you a $1,000 bonus on that. Well, okay, I didn't think about this. And, of course, Steve couldn't design anything. He's not a very good engineer. He's not an engineer, period. He's, you know, just a dilettante. But his buddy Waz is pretty good. And Waz was never an employee of Atari. He was over at HP, but he'd come in all night. Waz would stay up for 3 days, then sleep for a day and a half, and this was the way he did things. So he'd be up all night playing, I think we're driving games we were being burnt in at the time, and he'd be on the floor playing free play driving games all the time. One day I come into work, and he says, hey, Al, you got to see this. And I go in the lab, and there's Breakout, fully done. I'm going, what? I mean, this wasn't on the schedule. I'd never heard of it. I mean, it was like, here's a video game coming out of, like, what's the point of scheduling anything, you know? And it was like, Waz had done it. Well, great. And Waz did it in 3 days, no less than, or 2 days. It was amazing. And he had like 18 parts in it. I was like, whoa. Well, Nolan, because Waz gamed the rules that Nolan gave him. He said less than 50 chips. He didn't say you had to be able to buy the chips, or the chips existed. So Waz had brought in parts from HP that you couldn't buy. You know, I swear to God, I mean, it was like unbelievable. The game was a great game, but I couldn't understand how it was built. Only Waz could figure it out. It was not producible in any way, shape, or form, you know. And it actually languished in the lab for about a year. We needed a game, and so we gave it to a normal engineer who laid it out with 100 chips, you know, and it was a big hit. It was a big hit, but Nolan paid the $1,000 chip bonus to Steve, which is another story because Steve lied to Waz and said it was a $100 chip bonus. That's another story altogether. But that was where the breakup between Mr. Jobs and Mr. Wozniak occurred. And anyway, so.
I thought they started a company called Apple after that, though, didn't they?
Yeah, they started a company called Apple, but Waz didn't find out that his buddy had lied to him until the book was being written. I swear to God, Waz was by this time he was worth $100 million. He's riding on an airplane, first class, and he's reading the draft of the Little Emperor, whatever, the first book, and the guy got the story right, and Waz is going. And he calls me up. He says, was it $1,000 a chip or $100 a chip? It was $1,000 a chip. And he starts bawling. I mean, here's a guy that, you know, is worth $100 million, and he realizes his best buddy had lied to him. Now, the point is, the other thing is that Jobs doesn't like out spending any money. If you knew Jobs at that point in time, he was saffron robe, shaved head, barefoot, drove a ratty old Ford.
That brown bottle of liquid he'd wear on his belt.
Yeah.
Was disgusting.
Yeah. He had some health ideas and weird stuff, and you know, so he wasn't spending the money. He would probably have put the money into what became Apple, but the point was he lied to Waz. So anyhow,
wow, that's heavy.
All thanks to Nolan.
Ouch. Anyway, I guess this is a funny thing that happened to me. I was in, so I got hired into the pinball programming department, which I soon became chairman of the board of. And it's funny, the previous programmer, Fred Yates, which I hope is not here today, he had told everybody, he was actually a hardware guy, he really wasn't a programmer.
That's right.
And he had told everybody, you know, somebody had mentioned like, hey, can't you like flash a light on the game? You know, wouldn't that be kind of a cool idea, you know, flash a light, you know? And Fred, oh, that's impossible. Can't do it. Computer is not capable. And so everybody believed that. I mean, that was, you know, like, oh, you can't flash lights. That's just not possible. And because you'd lose the memory or something when it went off, you know. And but, you know, after being a UCB graduate, after about a couple of weeks on the job, I flashed a light, you know. And it was like, it was amazing. You know, it was like, everybody was like, oh, my God, he flashed a light. You know, this guy is... holy, you know, this guy's a genius. You know, it's like, wow, you know, this is amazing. What's he going to do next? Make a sound? You know, it's like, but that was bring out the brownies. Okay, but anyway, it was amazing how, and so often programmers, you know, it's like the Jurassic Park programmer syndrome, you know, where it's like, you just bullshit people. You're like, oh, we can't do that. You know, it's like, can't you make a, you know, a Macintosh? Nah, it's impossible. You know, it's just, and it's amazing what programmers got away with in those days. They would just blatantly lie to people and didn't have to do anything.
Plus, how many were there? I mean, you're like in a field of, I don't know, 30 cubicles. I mean, yeah. I went for 100 yards. It's like you were just a, you know, a piece of paper somewhere, you know.
Yeah. That was your revenge to the man.
Gene mentioned, Al mentioned Gene Lipkin. And Gene Lipkin was like the VP of CoinUp, and he was the guy who came in and killed Dave's game that the boat game. Go, boat games suck. and Gene would, he would, you know, make surprise attacks into engineering. And we eventually came up with something called the Lipkin switch. Now, when we were doing CoinUp games, I mean, every hardware was a little bit unique, and you'd have your controls and whatever, and you were always reading them directly. So we'd always wire up an extra switch, legitimately, that the code could read. And if that switch was thrown, we had some code that would just make it look, you know, some of us did this, not everybody, would just make it look like, you know, oh, the game crashed, or, you know, wacky lines on the screen, or, you know, just something like that to me. Gene, I can't show you the game. I got a bug. You know, I got to deal with that first so that he wouldn't come in and kill your game.
I remember a Fred Yates story, since I forgot about this guy. He wound up working for me later on in one of my secret projects, research project, that was eventually killed. And by this time, it was towards the end, and we were owned by Warner. And we're going to have a big tour by the wheels at Warner, Manny Girard, and I think maybe even Ross. Maybe not Ross wouldn't condescend to come by and walk around, but Manny did. The big tour. So I went to this area, and they had to see this group. And I went to Fred because he was always in trouble. He was sharp with the tongue. So I said, Fred, Manny's going to come by on Thursday and do a tour of the place. Why don't you take Thursday off? You know, just take the day off. Because I knew, you know. He says, no, I got work to do. I got to, you know. So I said, cause, you know, I said, look. He's a nice guy. He's got a lot of money. You know, he's not an engineer, so he's going to ask stupid questions. I don't like being asked stupid questions, but, again, try to take the – he wouldn't do it. So I said, look, if you can't say anything nice, just don't say anything, okay? Oh, sure. So what? So along comes the tour, and goes Manny, and he asks a question of Fred, and Fred basically said, you stupid shit, if you can't figure this out, how come you're running this big corp? Thank you very much, Fred, for your insight. Moving right along over here, you know, typical – typical Fred, yeah.
Fred Yates. I remember Gene Lipkin as the executioner. That's what we thought of him. I think when he would, you know, he'd walk by our game, he'd be checking it out. He also knew that we feared him. Although I have to say, there was a band, a narrow band in time where he could actually call a game for what it was, I think. I think he estimated a game's value pretty well at one point. And anyway... he had us all going in the pinball department by saying, okay, we got this licensed Superman, and you guys, you got to work like dogs. I don't know who we're going to give it to yet. You have to, you know, make your game. Let's see it. You, Richie and Slater, you guys go. And Eugene and I were working together. And what was the
code name?
He's the programmer. Remember him?
Howard Feldman.
Howard Feldman, that's right. Yeah. Howard Feldman, what a character. He's like, this is like, I don't know, kind of like Barney Fife, but with a, you know, maybe a pretty good engineering brain. And I just remember him being strange. Anyway, we beat on the game day and night. Just, I mean, we weren't getting paid anymore, you know. You know, we just beat on it day and night. We work on it as long as we could stay up and try to make the game. And then one day Gene Lipkin came through, and he peed on Gary's pinball and not on ours. And it was like, you know, a good break. We got to do Superman.
Yeah. Well, we had given him some brownies for lunch. So
yeah, I remember the brownies. That was after the brownie stage. Actually, brownies might not have been allowed at Atari at that point.
Okay.
That
was the beer bus sometime. Okay.
Actually, the Superman pinball machine was the best pinball machine Atari ever made. But I remember the decision that execs to realize we were losing almost $1,000 per machine. But it was a beautiful machine. I had one for a while myself. And we finally decided to disclose the division at that point. That was the last one we ever did. It was a heartbreaker.
Came out great, and George Opperman did a fine job, I got to say. You know,
oh, yeah,
I miss George Opperman. Yeah. He's like just a spectacular artist who didn't just do the product. He did all the marketing materials. We had a look. When we came to a show, George would make sure the whole booth, you know, all was unified in this one particular theme or graphics to match the game that was on the podium.
Yeah, the George Opperman style. And it was also used in some of the early Atari consumer boxes.
Well, a funny story about Opperman and that, he designed the Atari logo, the famous Atari logo.
Right,
and when Warner bought us, we paid like, I don't know, $500 for that. We hired him. It was a good job. Warner buys us, and they said, well, we got to redo your corporate image. So they're going to spend $100,000 doing the research, and they discovered that our name and our logo at the time was more well-known than Mickey Mouse. And they said, don't touch it. Don't touch it. That was Opperman. I mean, he was just dead on from the get-go. Too bad. Great man.
Yeah. Are you guys, and we have any collectors of like Opperman back glasses or boxes, consumer boxes or anything? Amazing stuff.